Our reading today is from one of my favorite authors, so you probably have to hear too much of him, but oh well, I'm the minister. It's from Gordon Atkinson. He calls it On Faith. In our world, we have separated mind from body to our great loss. Here, in this place, in this time, in this world, a man may betray his wife or neglect his children, but say he loves them down inside. B.S. There is no down inside. Love is something you do, not something you just feel. Likewise, we think that having faith means being convinced God exists in the same way we are convinced that chair exists. People who cannot be completely convinced of God's existence think that faith is impossible for them. Not so. People who doubt can have great faith, because faith is something you do, not something you think. In fact, the greater you doubt, the more heroic your faith. I learned on my journey that it doesn't matter in the least that I be convinced of God's existence. Whether or not God exists is none of my business, really. What do I know of existence? I don't even know how the VCR works. What does matter is whether or not I am faithful in my living. And I think faithful is a hell of a good word. It still has some of its original shine. It still calls us to action. Once I stumbled on that very old truth, I prayed the most honest prayer of my life. God, I don't have great faith, but I can be faithful. My belief in you may be seasonal, but my faithfulness will not. I will act as though my life and the lives of others matter. I will love. I have no greater gift to offer than my life. Take it. Amen. Today's sermon is really two stories and a song. And I am having an act of great faith. I have just left my manuscript back there. And so we're going to see how that goes. Our two stories are stories about two women who came into my life and left it all right around the same time in the summer of 2001 when I was serving as a chaplain during my seminary training at a hospital in the suburbs of Chicago. And I was assigned to the cancer ward. That was my beat, I guess. That was what I was called to do that summer. I also did on-call chaplaincy while I was there. And we got this sort of uncomfortable thing going where every time I came in through the doors of the hospital in the middle of the night, the nice ladies who worked the gift shop would avert their eyes because I had this sort of Grim Reaper vibe where when I showed up, you knew that something was going down. It was a traumatic and beautiful and amazing and learning-filled time of my life. But these two women that I want to talk about are two very different women who wanted two very different things from the chaplain. The first one, her name was Caroline, and Caroline called down to the chaplain's office and almost sounded too eager to get the chaplain up there right now. I knew she had some high expectations of just what it was that I could bring with me when I walked in that room. And I showed up, and she lay there in the bed. She was surrounded entirely by angels, literally angels, plaster angels, plastic angels, stuffed angels, pictures of angels, taped to the wall, and scriptural quotations. There was a scriptural quotation taped to this woman's lampshade. There were scriptural quotations taped underneath the angels. The angels were holding up scriptural quotations by their wings. And I knew when I walked into that place that this woman wanted of me more than to just be Nancy or to just be the chaplain. She wanted me to come in there and speak for and witness for God. That's a mighty tough act to live up to, but that's what she wanted. And so I sat down and I started to talk my minister talk, and she was, Caroline, maybe 55, really way too young to be as sick as she was. And I'm not sure what kind of cancer she had. It might have been uterine, but she had fought it for a really long time. And she had that gaunt look that people have when you know they're getting toward the end. And when I got in there, Caroline laying there on that bed, surrounded by angels, all she wanted to do was testify. Was have me be there as a representative of God to hear her proclaim her faith. And that's what she did. She told me how grateful she was, how humbled she was by the fact that Jesus Christ had died for her sins and saved her, and that she knew because she prayed and she believed and her faith was strong that God would and could save her from this great scourge. And her voice got louder and louder as she testified just like that. She knew, she believed, and she knew. And as I sat there, I felt myself tensing up, getting more and more nervous, because I knew, because I had read her chart, that the hospital staff recommended for her that she go on hospice care as soon as possible, and it was my job to tell her this. And so, being my very wise 22-year-old self, I laid it on her, and she would have none of it. None of it. And she said that I didn't understand how deep her faith was. And she asked me just to pray with her and to read for her some scriptures. And I did. I read for her Psalm 139, "For you were born, I knew you in the womb, I formed you." And I prayed the best prayers I knew how, and I left. And about a week later, I got another call, of course. And it was from Caroline's family. She was up in the room, and she was dying. And she was near the end. And when I got there, I walked in that room, and that woman's fists were clenched. Her jaw was set. Her teeth locked down, and she couldn't talk. And I saw, or at least fancied I saw in her eyes, a look not of shining hope, but of extreme bitterness. And when her eyes met mine, I saw, or fancied I saw, that woman looked at me like I had lied to her. And I walked away wondering whatever I could have done to make that ending better than it was. Even though I did everything right, even though I did everything that the pastor's supposed to do, I represented God for her, and God just hadn't come through. And then there was Tamara. Tamara had been in and out of the hospital for a long time. She'd been in and out since she was about 12. And so most of her life had been lived in the confines of the hospital bed and her hospital bed in the living room at home. Those two places is where she went from 12 to 25. She was just a few years older than me at the time. And I don't even think she was on my ward, but they figured two young women would get along well together, so they put us together. And Tamara, unlike Caroline, had no interest in me representing God for her. Mostly, she just wanted to see what the new rookie chaplain would have to say when they met her. And so I came up there, and I, of course, tried to ply my ministerial tricks, and she would have none of it. Tamara was about 25, and she had a lifelong congenital disease that she had inherited from her mother. It was the disease that had actually killed her mother. I'm not even sure what it was called, but it was a disease that affected her tissues so that she was incredibly fragile. And especially the most fragile tissues in the body, like the inside of the mouth, her intestines, the lining of her stomach, her lips, all those things that are already fragile on a person were so fragile on her that they burst and broke all the time. This was a woman who could literally die by eating a cheeseburger and some French fries. And at the point in her life when I met her, she had 3 feet of small intestine left. That was it. Every time something burst, she had to have another surgery. And every time she had surgery, the stitches wouldn't heal, and they'd have to go in again. And by the time I walked in that room ready to apply my ministerial tricks, Tamara had had so many surgeries in such a short span of time that they actually left an open place in her stomach so that they could get in there easily the next time and the next time and the next. And so I walked in to that situation, and I tried to say what pastors say, you know, that how are you bit. And she basically laughed at me. And I said at one point, and would you like to talk about how God impacts your life? And she said, I'm not making this up, I'd really rather talk about my dog. And she did. She went on for 20 minutes talking about her dog, who happened to be a teacup poodle, and whose toenails she painted regularly. And she went on for 20 minutes also talking about her favorite kind of music and talking about incessantly her younger brother, who I think she had ambitions to set me up with. She kept making these arrangements so that we would both be in the hospital room at the same time. And she'd say really embarrassing things like, Scotty, did you know that Nancy's very close with her parents? And then she'd be like, Nancy, did you know Scotty likes architecture? And we'd look at each other like, great, yeah. Thanks. And Tamara wrote poetry. When she could write, she would hold the pen and she would write it for herself. And when she couldn't, she would recruit one of me or her brother to do it for her. And when finally I stopped trying to ply my tricks and just started showing up, we ended up having a date 3 times a week to play gin rummy in her room, which she beat me at every single time. And it took 3 months of my not prodding and my not poking and my not plying my tricks when she finally started to talk about what her illness meant to her. And one day, she was sitting there in her bed, cracking some joke as usual, probably making fun of me because I'm good at being made fun of. And she held her stomach and she said, this is supposed to be where all the good things happen. This is where I'm supposed to get my nutrients. This is where I'm supposed to be able to make a baby, and for me it's nothing but pain. And she said a little while after that she knew the end was close, and we all knew it, and that she didn't want to do this in this way. And so we called all the people that mattered together, and we signed all the papers, and we ensured her that she would have no more surgery, no more, and that she could live her last days laughing and playing gin rummy and talking about her dog and trying to set up her brother and I, although that didn't happen. And when she died, she laid there on her bed, and her dying words, this is almost too fabulous to be real, she looked at us and she said, heaven looks like Scotland. I can't imagine a better image of heaven than that. Heaven looks like green and rolling hills. And she was gone. That was the first eulogy I ever wrote and spoke. I had to borrow someone else's pulpit robe, and it was too short, so it was like this. And I stood there, and I preached a sermon about this passage in Matthew that says, don't hide your light under a bushel basket. It was a very cheesy sermon illustration, but it was appropriate for her. These two women facing the end, these two women grappling with their way, trying desperately to find something in the midst of all that hurting to hold on to. Two women with deep faith and loving families. One who met the end with clenched fist, and one who met the end and told me, heaven looks like Scotland. What was the difference between those two? What made one leave so bitterly and one so well? It was, I think, their respective faiths. One of them believed that life mattered even as it was. The other believed that life mattered if it could be fixed. One would rather talk about her dog than God. The other would rather talk about God than life itself. The difference was not the measure of their faiths, for both believed very deeply. Their faiths were deep and wide. The difference was the way their faiths caused them to live. One believed in a miracle-working God. The other believed in a God who lived in and between the long, boring days and painted poodle toenails, in between hands of gin rummy and poems written in failing handwriting. Julian of Norwich, the Christian mystical writer, wrote that My spiritual awakening began the moment I saw God in all things, and all things in God. Her faith was a faith that included all things, including her suffering, and called her to live a meaningful life within the confines that held her, and that's not unlike the faith that held Tamara. After Caroline and Tamara died, I could not stop thinking about those two passages into the mystery. Caroline believed she would be saved in a very particular way by a very particular God. And when God didn't arrive in that particular package in that particular way, her faith crumbled at the gates of all that lays beyond, and her shining eyes turned angry. But Tam believed she was already saved. She was already whole in that broken body, already held by something so powerful that it made poetry and dogs and gin rummy in a hospital bed enough of a life to be celebratory of it. Salvation didn't come in a particular package, and she didn't expect it to. She had faith, not in otherworldly graces, but in life. It is a faith we would do well to emulate. Faith that life matters even for the short period of time we have to live it in. Faith not in the divine lawgiver and the magic fingers of justice, but in the solid grace of every single day, pregnant with meaning and full of God. Faith that things may or may not go as you planned, but you will always have the strength and the courage to meet life head on. Faith, something to hold on to. In the living of our daily lives, so many of us search for meaning, for something to have faith in, and underneath it all, we're searching for a reason to love life. We assume that the object of our faith must be some particularly divinely powerful something, or it's nothing at all, but Tamara knew better. Whatever it was she had faith in wasn't enshrouded in doctrine. It was life. She believed in life itself, and she believed from the narrow confines of that bed that God and love and meaning moved even in her life, in the pain and the boredom and in the face of the imminent end. This week I remembered a song that I put on repeat that summer when Caroline and Tamara died. My CD's all scratched and dirty because I listened to it so much. It's a song by John Prine, some of you might know. It's called Angel from Montgomery. And it remains perhaps my all-time favorite piece of music. I listened to it so many times that summer because I was thinking about what it is to live faithfully and honestly, even in the midst of the mundane and the painful. I was thinking about Tamara and the fact that it doesn't matter what you hold on to as long as you hold on to something that gives your life meaning. There's a line in that song that says, "How the hell can a person go to work in the morning, come home in the evening, and have nothing to say? How can we live even one single day of these abundantly blessed lives without daring to make some meaning out of it? How could we live one moment without remembering that life is worth living? How could she lie there when everything was ending and talk for hours and hours about the meaning in her life when the rest of us have a hard time coming up with one thing to say?" Our lives are sometimes narrow. We find ourselves caught on the edge of scary things, caught in the middle of the mundane, caught on the end of a long day, with nothing to give the hours that have passed significance. Sometimes those of us who have really great lives have trouble believing that they matter. Sometimes those of us who are most blessed need a little faith to keep us going. In the song John Prine wrote, "Make me an angel that flies from Montgomery. Make me a poster of an old rodeo. Just give me one thing that I can hold on to. To believe in this living is a hard way to go." Tom's agreed to play that for us.
This old house would have burned down.
Too many people in the world, including those who believe and have great faith, have nothing to hold on to in the end. Like Caroline, when things go wrong, they lose their faith not just in God, but in life. In the end, a saving faith involves believing in this life and loving it for what it is, not for what you want it to be, but for what it is. Faithful people choose to live their lives as if life matters, whether or not the facts support it. Tamra chose to live her life as if every day made a difference. Maybe she didn't want to talk about God because she didn't know what she believed, but she lived faithfully nonetheless. Faith isn't really about believing. It's about choosing to live your life in a certain way. Perhaps it's about living as if you believe. It's about living in a world where you matter and your actions matter and love matters. It's not about thinking. It's about doing. I know that in times of sorrow and doubt and suffering, believing in this living is a hard, hard way to go. But it's the only way. Because difficult things will happen, are happening all around us. Because the things we fear most knock at our doors even as we speak. But living in faith means living with the assumption that we are bold to face them head on, with or without a miracle. May we have something to hold on to that reminds us we are whole. May we have faith enough to carry on even when we are afraid. May we be held and comforted and loved. May we believe in this living, no matter how hard it sometimes is, for that is the deepest, hardest, and most rewarding work of faith.